and welcome to RTÉ Radio 1's The Rolling Wave podcast with me, Aoife Ní Coirmic. In this episode, I'll be talking to the editor of the Journal of Music, Tóner Quinn. In November 2000, Tóner Quinn published the first edition of a new magazine called The Journal of Music in Ireland. In 2010, the magazine was moved entirely online, and since then, it has been known as The Journal of Music. And although Tóner Quinn is a fine fiddle player with a great interest in and love of traditional music, The Journal of Music is not just about traditional music, but it's about all music: jazz, classical, folk, contemporary, and everything else. Over the years, Tóner Quinn has written thought-provoking editorials and articles about topics as diverse as David Gray, Tony McMahon himself, An Spidéal, Gunda na Gaillimhe, John Cage, John Blacking, as well as many pieces on music education, government policies on the arts, and Ireland's relationship with traditional music. He recently published a book called What Ireland Can Teach the World About Music and Other Essays, which features a number of his editorials and articles from the Journal of Music over the past 23 and a little bit years. I met Tóner recently in the RTÉ studio in Galway, and he spoke to me about this new book. Tóner Quinn, you're very welcome to The Rolling Wave. You were 26 when the JMI, as it was then known, was first published. What was the impetus to establish it at that time?
When I look back or think back, I'm pretty sure at the time I wanted to write. That was one of the, and I was writing, probably struggling to write and thinking to myself, there must be an easier way to do this, or actually it might be easier to publish other people who could write much better than me. That was part of it. I was also very interested in publishing. I'd just done a master's in publishing in Scotland. I was interested in the history of Irish publishing. I was interested in the role that periodicals had played in Irish cultural history over the years. I was interested in ideas and debate and discussion about music, and I had a lot of questions. I just had a lot of questions, and I thought that starting a periodical, a magazine, was a way of actually addressing these questions. Now, that's a really complicated way of going around it, going about it. It would have been much easier to just write and be published by other publications, but it's just in my nature to, I suppose I have a slightly entrepreneurial nature, and so it's in my nature to just start stuff like that. I had no idea that I would still be doing it 24 years later.
Yeah. There was no grand plan for a quarter of a century.
There was no plan beyond the second issue.
Okay.
That's how far ahead I was thinking. I figured that I would have everything wrapped up, all the existential questions about Irish music, I'd have everything wrapped up in a couple of years, and then I'd move on. Mm-hmm. But what happens when you start a magazine is that people start writing, people start responding, they respond to your writing, you learn more, you are in touch with more writers, people are, you know, critiquing what you're saying, and you feel you have to actually explain more about what you're doing, and it just grows, and it grew. And there was a relative outpouring of writing at the time. There was just so much to say, and so few places to say it, I suppose.
That interest in thinking about music, or the philosophy of music, or writing about music, where did that come from? Was that from through education, through college, or where did you get that?
I think that came from my background. My father's a musician, and we often talked about music. He also, you know, his kind of dinner table was famous for making us think. He always wanted deep conversations about things. And when I started learning music, this was something he had an interest in. So we would have a lot of discussions about, and he had a classical music perspective, because he played piano, whereas I was coming from traditional music. And so the traditional classical sort of discussion was always there, and we would play together. And I think it was probably in my nature as well to be questioning and thinking about these things. But I think a lot of it is in my background.
And, you know, the musics as such, because it is the Journal of Music, it's not the Journal of Traditional Music, so it does cover jazz and classical music, and we'll come to that in a while. But your own background originally was as a traditional fiddle player. That's how I knew you, how I know you. Was that the musical path, or were there classical music lessons in there too?
Well, I've specialised in traditional Irish fiddle. I mean, I was sent to lessons when I was 11. But I was growing up in Bray. It wasn't a hotbed for traditional Irish music at the time. I think I was, you know, the only person for a time who played traditional music in my entire school. So I felt like kind of a fish out of water. But I did do classical violin lessons after that. I learned classical piano. I learned rock and pop guitar. I wanted to be a composer for a time. In the end, I specialised in traditional Irish music, but all those other musics are there all the time. A lot of what I listen to is classical music. And then I end up playing traditional music, but it all feeds into, every musician will tell you that, it all feeds into each other. And whatever walls or boundaries there were in music back then when I started, a lot of them have just dissolved. Just dissolved. You can see that in folk and traditional music today. It is reaching into so many other areas. And traditional music is completely opened up today as an art form. And so people are able to actually reach into it more from other genres, and traditional musicians are reaching out more. I think that was always there in traditional music, but I think it's more prevalent even today.
You are both obviously a musician then and a writer. Are they very distinct creative pursuits, or do they have anything in common?
I always saw myself as a musician and never saw myself as a writer until maybe about 10 years ago. And after about 10 years of writing, people started calling me a writer, but I never thought of myself as a writer. I started to get really serious about it then, and probably writing a lot more. But the difference between the two, I slowly learned the difference between the two. They both use the same creative energy. I used to try and do the two at the same time. And then I realised, oh, why does that work? Why they're all burning the same fuel, as Tony McMahon would have said. They're burning the same fuel. The creative energy that goes into writing is very intense, but also playing is very, very intense. And I found I couldn't do the two at the same time. So I've kind of learned to get the balance right at this stage. Once I've finished writing something, I might return to playing for a while. And then after a while, when I'm playing, a lot of the time, you know, that's making me think about music. And then I might return to writing. And I'm switching between the two all the time. But it's been a real discovery for me over 20 years to discover how to get that right. You know, writing about music is always treated as something secondary, but they actually, they burn the same amount of fuel for me anyway. You know?
In the early days, and returning to this book, What Ireland Can Teach the World About Music and Other Essays, which is written by Tony Quinn and just very recently published. In the early days, you wrote that you wanted to start a conversation about music. Why was that important to you? And do you think, you know, we're having enough of those conversations now?
I think back then, there was a lot going on in Irish music and Irish culture. We were coming out of the 90s. It was the Celtic Tiger. There was a lot of economic change in the country. And a lot of that was exerting itself on music, putting music under pressure to be something, to say something, or to play a particular type of music. And I was thinking about that a lot. But I have to say, I want to start a conversation because of my own ignorance. I didn't have the answers to any of these questions. I really didn't. But I knew there were people out there. There was lots of writers. I remember sitting down when I started the Journal of Music. I sat down and I just wrote a list of names of all the people that I wanted to write for me. And I gradually ticked it off over two decades. And they all did eventually write for me. And it was through other people writing. And I'm talking at the beginning, there were composers like Roger Doyle and Raymond Dean and Benjamin Dwyer and Jane O'Leary. And they were all writing. A lot of the writers are coming from classical and contemporary music initially, but then gradually more writers from traditional music. There was Kieran Carson. And then Tony McMahon started writing for me as well. And they gradually informed me. And after about a decade, I felt a little bit more confident about my own ideas, and I'd learned from them about how to have the confidence to articulate yourself in writing. And so it became less about sort of questions and debates and what's going on in the world, and really actually about a clear idea about actually articulating the value of music and keeping an eye on what's happening in our society and the devaluing of music, and how can we stand up for it, and how can we speak about it, and all the time trying to deepen the discourse about music. And I don't think it's deep enough. I don't. I mean, the amount of people who actually write about music, you could probably count them for their job, like me, you know, or it's most of my job, writing about music. We could probably count them on one hand, you know. But this is a PR world. How many people work in PR and marketing? Thousands. So we are really outnumbered. Now, I don't have a problem with PR and marketing. You need PR marketing to promote concerts, to make sure that there are people attending concerts, festivals, listening to recordings. But that conversation is reliant on writers and editors, and they are in the minority. And they will always be in the minority in a world of, you know, extensive PR. And you have a lot of large companies who are trying to promote a certain message. And, you know, I never wanted the Journal of Music to just be a vehicle for PR. That was really what I resisted all the time. I wanted to be a vehicle for thinking about music and deepening the discourse about music, because it is powerful stuff. It has changed my life. Every musician I know, I was at the announcement of the Grantham Kill recipients this week. And the first thing that Derek Hickey said when he got up to sort of, you know, respond to being announced as the recipient of the Grantham Kill was, he said, "I do not know where I would be without music. It literally transforms lives." Seamus Begley said the same thing. "Where would we be without this music?" So it really requires a lot of deep thinking, this stuff. It's a social glue. It transforms lives. It brings generations together. I don't understand it. And I'm just thinking about it all the time.
You know, one of the things that has changed a lot in terms of music in Ireland in the past 25 years, you know, over the course of the life of the Journal of Music, is that the number of people doing traditional music at degree level or pursuing music in third level and beyond, has that contributed, do you think, to the types of discussions and discourse we're having about music today? Or do you see any visible difference as a result of that shift in education?
Well, I think it has been a source of writers for us. You know, one of our main writers on traditional music is Adrian Scahill, who's in the Department of Music in Maynooth. Niall Keegan wrote a lot for us as well, from the University of Limerick. So definitely writers do come from the universities, writers who can write for a wide audience and are very accessible. So that's definitely making a difference. I often imagine, you know, graduates of music and traditional music today would probably come out and probably take the Journal of Music for granted and think, isn't it wonderful that we have this forum for discussion, not realising that when I certainly emerged from my degree in the 1990s, there was no such periodical where we could actually engage in these kind of discussions. So I'm really relieved that it's there for them. That's one thing I'm relieved about. But definitely, I think there are readers. I think there are readers, and they do engage with it. And they give us feedback. And also, from that feedback, we then develop editorially. So, you know, they're an important part of what we do these days, yeah.
You mentioned at the start of our conversation that when you set up the Journal of Music in 2000, that there was an awful lot going on in the world of music. And I remember an awful lot of talk about innovation versus tradition. And, you know, there were conferences and talks about it. And in 2003, you published a talk given by Martin Hayes, where he said that, and I'm going to quote, "We were treating the music as an unruly teenager to whom we were unwilling to offer full independence, lest it not adhere to some static notion of what the tradition is." Do you think that the anxiety about that, those kind of arguments, has gone now? Are we more willing to offer music its full independence now, do you think?
Yes, we're less anxious about Irish music. We are less anxious about it. The sort of debate that Martin Hayes was referring to then, it's because Irish music became a vehicle for representing aspects of Ireland. Politically, economically, it was used to sell Ireland, and that put an awful lot of pressure on the music. So we were right to be anxious about it at the time. But we've had that discussion, and I think we're a little bit clearer about where the lines are as regards music. And also, I mean, traditional music, it's difficult to believe this, but it has become even more confident over the past two decades, which kind of amazes me. You know, I was at the RTÉ Folk Awards and I saw Suirchán Ní Shoilí give a solo on Illan Pipes there. And I just, the lack of fear was incredible. Like, it's such a statement for a young musician. And myself and other musicians were talking about this and just going, look at the confidence of this generation. So there is less anxiety, but still, you know, these issues don't go away. You know, we live in a commercial, you know, world, capitalistic world, where music is a very, very useful tool for selling things. And Irish music will always be attractive for that kind of hyper branding. And as musicians, we need to be clear. We need to talk about that. We need to think about that and be clear about that in our minds. I mean, we see examples all the time. The most obvious example is obviously in South by Southwest just a couple of weeks ago, where we probably are not going to get into that. But, you know, a whole lot of Irish bands decided not to perform at South by Southwest because of the marketization of music. And that's a clear example of where it happened. They saw that there was arms manufacturers and the American army sponsoring the festival. And they said that's where the line is. And they were absolutely right. And that's a major statement by musicians to give up commercial opportunities like that. Artists make extraordinary interventions like that all the time. They shine the light for us. They did it during COVID. When everybody was shocked by COVID, it was artists who, you know, shone a light for us. And now again, in this crisis that we're dealing with now in Palestine, once again, Irish musicians shining a light at South by Southwest. But that marketization, I call it, I was writing about it recently, that marketization of the Irish mind, I call it, where everything is up for sale. Everything's up for sale. Doesn't matter what it is. Let's use Irishness. Let's use music. Let's use Irish culture. Let's use Irish identity to sell, sell, sell. There has to be a line. There has to be a line. Often musicians will show us where that line is, and I appreciate that. But I write about it a lot because it's something we need to think about.
You know, you mentioned Tony McMahon earlier, and you know he would have been one of the strongest and most vociferous speakers against that kind of culture of everything being for sale. And you write so well about his McMahon from Clare album in one of the essays in this book. And I'm trying to remember the exact quote, but it's, you know, a gift to humanity, I think you described it as. Why did you say that? Why?
Well, that was Tony. He inspired and challenged my generation. There's no doubt about it. You know, I grew up listening to him. I got to know him. I was sitting on the Dart one day and I saw him sitting. I'd been listening to his music and I saw him sitting at the other end of the carriage. And I walked straight up to him and I said, "Mr. McMahon, hello, how are you? My name is Tonor Quinn," you know. And
a scary thing to do at the same time.
He was actually very busy reading an article in the newspaper. He tolerated me for a few minutes. But we stayed in touch. We stayed in touch. And, you know, when I was in college in Waterford, I asked him to come down and give him a talk with Brian O'Shea. We set up a Trish Music Society and he came down and spoke to us. We were very inspired by him. He challenged us. All the time. He challenged us. And I suppose as I get older, I realise all the lessons that I learned from Tony, those kind of lessons about thinking, what is music for? Is it to sell stuff or is it actually a transformational experience to affect, as Tony used to say, the chemical makeup of the mind? That's the way he used to say it. But he also, you know, he used to describe music. I don't know that quote, but he called Irish music a gift to humanity. Dispersed with the abandon of wildflowers. And, you know, when you think about that, when you think about music like that, not as a vehicle for our careers or for selling or anything like that, it's a really, really powerful statement. And that's what we learned from him. And I suppose, you know, as you get older, you realise those lessons that you learn from musicians like that, now that they're gone, you go, well, I better hang on to those. I better hang on to those and talk about those. You know, I find now my own son is 24 and he's a musician and I find myself talking to him about people like Tony McMahon and conveying what I learned from them. And he's kind of fascinated by these kind of strong statements about music. But it makes sense to him because he goes, yeah, I feel passionate about music. So, OK, it's OK to follow that line. Yeah.
Music criticism or criticism of books or CDs or concerts, that forms part of what you do in the Journal of Music as well. I don't know who came up with that quote. It's a bit trite, I suppose, but the writing about music is about dance, like dancing about architecture. But the function of music criticism, what is its function and how good or bad are we at doing it, do you think?
Well, that's something that I've had to think about a lot over the past couple of decades, I suppose. I mean, writing about music serves a few purposes. One of the most fundamental roles it has is to just record what is happening. That there is music being produced, important music, significant music, interesting, extraordinary music all the time. And it's important to record that. It's important to record it to disperse information about it to a wider audience, to build audiences for artists who are doing something interesting, something as simple as that. And then also to for the future, so that generations coming along, they can look back and see that there's a record of that music. So we are just recording and documenting. I see that as a very important role. The other side of it, to give some feedback on a new piece of music, it's very interesting. I find it interesting, even at this stage, to look back at music that was produced 10, 15 years ago and see how we thought about it then. And we can learn from that. The actual act of writing about music, it's never easy. It's never, writing about music is not easy. I've developed a lot of ideas about it. One of the simplest ways is just to be really informed about an artist's career. The more you listen to an artist, the more you listen to the music, the much much easier the writing will come. I find that if I listen to lots of music, if I go to lots of concerts, the writing will come out quickly. But if I dry up creatively, if I'm not going to things, if I'm not listening to music, if I'm not reading, the writing stops. So the writing about music, that quote, it is kind of trite and it really doesn't say anything.
No. But it's amusing.
It's amusing, but it doesn't help us really. No. Because writing about music has all these roles. The other part about it that I think is important is that writing about music is also expressing yourself. I'm expressing myself when I'm writing about music. I go to concerts, I'm in the environment of an artist, and then I feel like responding to that. Sometimes it makes me want to play, sometimes it makes me want to think, and sometimes I want to write. So, you know, sometimes when we publish a writer and I get some feedback on, they shouldn't have said this and they shouldn't have said, and I said, but that writer is expressing themselves as well, and they have a right to do that. And that's the beauty of what we have at the moment, that we can say what we think. Saying what you think, very important thing that we need to hang on to. And so I encourage that in our writers.
So then, like a bad review, you know, what's the value of giving a bad review? You think that that's just allowing the writer to express their views?
Well, I don't encourage writers to slate performances or anything like that. But certainly if a writer... who is informed about the work of an artist and says, no, I don't think the artist has actually achieved. The first question, as I learned from the composer John McLaughlin, is what is the artist trying to do? OK, and the only way you'll have an idea of what the artist is trying to do is if you understand their music, if you've listened to their music. Once you have that basis, they go, OK, this is their new work. Are they achieving what they set out to do? And then a writer is able to provide some sort of... informed assessment, which is useful to the reader, because the reader who may have also been at the concert or is interested in that artist, I find readers are often reading our publishing in the Journal of Music, our reviews, because they want to test out their own assumptions. They have an instinct about a piece of music. They think something is important. They think something is not so good. And they want to test their assumptions against what our writers are doing. So it also contributes to the dialogue. Yeah.
And dialogue is very important to your philosophy or your ethos of the Journal of Music. You write about that in your first essay, and you talk a couple of times about providing a space where people can discuss and have conversations with each other. And I'm wondering, those kinds of conversations between jazz maybe or classical music or traditional music, do they happen, and have you got examples of when those three traditions might have engaged with each other, or is that still a very slow moving thing?
Well, I would imagine that a lot of our writing, I hope it sparks dialogues. Now, they may happen
elsewhere.
Mm. They don't necessarily need to happen in the Journal of Music. Mm. Certainly in the beginning, when there were less... We're talking about a magazine that started in 2000. Mm. Now, not everybody was on the internet or had an email address or anything. And so a lot of the discussion would take place within the letters section of the Journal of Music. Eventually, once social media hit critical mass in 2007, 2008, the conversation moved elsewhere. Now, a lot of the comments on our writing of the Journal of Music, I will see on social media. I won't see them in the comments section of the Journal of Music. That's where the dialogue is happening. But there needs to be a substantial spark for that discussion and some sort of substantial writing and thinking about music. So that's where we see our role these days. We don't necessarily see is that we're going to try and have the social media conversation. That's a separate thing these days. But there have been examples, in the early days. One of the essays I have in that book is about traditional and classical music in Ireland. And there was no dialogue between the two. And there were examples where Richard Pine had an article and then Emer Mayock wrote in and then Donal Lunny wrote in, and there were those kind of discussions happening. But now it's all on social media, which is fine. Mm. So I focus more on the writing, really.
And, the Journal of Music is very much associated with you. So how curated is it by you, or how much leeway do you allow in terms of publishing views that maybe you don't agree with?
Oh, that happens all the time. I look for strong writers and they challenge me, and nothing that we publish goes straight to print. We're always, myself and the writers are going back and forward, agreeing, and I'm learning all the time from that. I tried to give them as total freedom of expression, and I tried to challenge them what they think and to fine tune their arguments all the time. The Journal of Music is associated with me at this stage, but we have a large group of writers at this stage, and all of whom are much better than me, I think. And I'm very happy to actually give them assignments and have them review and them write rather than me. I kind of write when I really have something to say. But a lot of the time I'm editing, publishing, focusing on the commercial side. I mean, I'm running essentially, it's an arts business, I suppose, but it is a business. And it is publishing. And so I am a publisher. That's what I'm doing most of the time. Yeah.
The title of the book is brilliant.
Thank you.
What Ireland Can Teach the World About Music and Other Essays. So we should talk about the article which gives the book its title. What is it that we can teach the world about music?
Yeah, well, that's just one essay that I wrote. And I wrote it, the morning after the Kailura concert, which took place in London. And I saw once again this phenomenon where, you know, I thought it was fascinating that when the Queen came to Ireland, we put on a concert of Irish music. And then when Michael D went to London, we put on a concert of Irish music, or the English did. And I just thought, look at the power of this music. What do we have in this country? Do we understand it? And I wrote this article, What Ireland Can Teach the World About Music, where I tried to put forward three sort of suggestions for, is this what makes our music special? One of them was the spontaneity in Irish music. Now, we see it in traditional music, this idea that a group of musicians can get together, having never met before in their life, never shared any repertoire. They don't even need an audience, and they can play together for several hours and then never meet again. Now, that kind of spontaneity is extraordinary. Now, it happens in other places around the world, maybe not in the same way, but how did we get here? How do we arrive at this stage where that's quite normal? And not just normal for us who've been playing for years, but for teenagers. That I see these social media videos of them playing on trains, playing on planes, playing on the streets of the Fla, non-stop, playing everywhere. Where do they learn that spontaneity? Is it part of our nature in Ireland? Did we develop it? Is it due to our displaced nature, due to our colonised history? Is it our reaction to oppression? But whatever it is, it's a part of our Irish music culture, and then it spills out into other things. You know, I often think of the Grafton Street busk every year, and I look at it and I go, look at all these people just singing on the streets at Christmas, that Glenn Hansard organises. And I go, you know, is that spilling over from our traditional music culture, this idea of let's get in the streets and sing? And then there are other aspects, the educational aspect in traditional music, this compulsion that everybody in traditional music to pass on the music to other people, to give them information about where I got this tune, and this connection, constantly trying to connect them. I'm always amazed when I'm in a session, if there's a child playing a simple tune, silence. Much more of a silence than it would be for experienced musicians. And the respect. And then I look at, you know, U2 sponsoring Music Generation. Of all the things they could sponsor, a music education initiative. And I just think, is that our passing on culture spilling out again? And then the other thing that fascinates me about traditional music is all the different levels playing together, all the different generations playing together. And the fact that in a small country, and we play in small spaces, this is another thing that's interesting, we play in small back rooms, as Ciarán Carson used to write, and this kind of intense activity in a small space, that creates competition. It means we learn faster. It means we develop faster. It means you have really experienced musicians playing in close proximity with, you know, novices, and everybody learns very quickly. And I think that environment has created what we have today, which I have to repeat, I still don't fully understand it. But I do think that if we did understand it, if we really did actually have these kind of conversations about how did we get here in Irish music, that a lot of other countries around the world could learn a lot from this. So that's the idea behind that. I say, What Ireland Can Teach the World About Music is how we got here. And, you know, this social glue that we've created, it brings people together, more important than ever right now, you know, as we have so many different communities here. And music is going to play such a big role in bringing people, communities together. And it brings people out of their homes. Mm. Everybody is at home. Music brings them out. I see this happen all the time. We're very fortunate. We need to talk about it so that we hold on to it and so that others can learn from it.
You write about John Blacking in your book. He was a very well-known ethnomusicologist who worked, I think, for a while in Queens and in Belfast. And you have an essay called John Blacking's Common Sense View. Tell me how he described folk music versus what is sometimes called art music.
Yeah, well, I discovered John Blacking when I was studying music, and his ideas were liberating for us because we were folk musicians and therefore we were lesser than classical musicians, and we needed some kind of philosophy that would help us out of that. And John Blacking's book provided it. His idea was that folk music was when the music enhanced a social occasion, and art music was when the music was the reason for the occasion. So a stage performance was art music, but folk music could be when it enhanced the occasion. I suppose a spontaneous singing session at some family event or something like that. But the thing about it is that that idea was liberating for us as students, because we felt not as important as classical musicians. And therefore, that kind of liberated us and showed us a different way of thinking about music. And that's what was great about John Blacking's work.
You know, we spoke at the start, you're a fiddle player as well as a writer, and you wanted to be a composer. I'm not sure if you're still writing music much these days, but, you know, your passion for music is so evident in so many of these essays. Often, sadly, you know, when people pass away and you write so knowledgeably and comprehensively about them, you know, people will always know that they'll get the facts, but they'll also get a sense of the person. I think when you write about somebody, you know, Mihalo Sulu, and there are plenty of examples in this book, Sean Keane, Tony McMahon. Is there one musician, do you think, who has had an effect or an influence on your thinking about music?
All of those musicians that you've mentioned, I suppose Tony McMahon was a big influence. John Blacking was a big influence. Martin Hayes was an influence. All of these people who were thinking about music, but so many more. I mean, I remember interviewing Cuilín O'Rahilla, and he really, you know, changed the way I was thinking. He was just at the beginning of his kind of exploratory journey. Every single musician I meet, I have to say, really makes me think about music. Those pieces that I write, those kind of, I suppose they're obituaries, I often write those in shock that a musician has passed that you think is always going to be there. And I suddenly realise when they've passed away how important their music was to me. I mean, Sean Keane is a perfect example. When he passed away, it was kind of unexpected. And I realised how intensively I had listened to his music for so many decades, and I was pulling out the vinyl albums and having them in the office while I was writing, just sitting there reminding me of all of the tunes. So often, you know, these musicians are influencing us all the time. We don't realise until they're gone. And then I always feel the need to articulate what I learned from them, articulate what I heard in their music, and to get it down. It's kind of a way of coming to terms with it, I suppose. Not that I knew these people personally. Most of them I don't. But when you listen to a musician intensively for very many years, you feel you know their music very intimately. You know, absolutely. You feel you have a relationship to them.
Absolutely. That can be quite shocking sometimes, I think, when somebody passes that you didn't actually know, and you can feel it so deeply, you know, when they're gone.
And we have seen a generational change. And, you know, in traditional music, you kind of feel the responsibility that, you know, there's musicians passing on and there's a new generation coming, and you're not the young person anymore. You have to
speak for yourself.
I will speak for myself. I will speak for myself. But
you and I are here in the RTÉ studio in Galway, and I want to ask you about RTÉ. You know, we had a conversation before when you published a piece called 10 Impossible Ideas for Traditional Music, and that's there as a podcast in the Rolling Wave podcasts if anyone wants to listen back to it. So I'm not going to go over all those again, but at the time, one of your ideas was connected to RTÉ and your view that RTÉ needed a group head of music. But you recently published another essay which came after the book. So but it was published in the Journal of Music, stressing RTÉ's importance to music in Ireland. How well do you think RTÉ looks after that responsibility?
Well, I think the fact that it has a significant music infrastructure is proof that it has looked after it. I'm worried about what's going to happen in the future with all of these cuts. But the music element of RTÉ is so important to musicians in the country. It has an orchestra. It has all of these music programmes. It has these music awards. It has an archive. It's a global hub for Irish music. And that's the way we need to think about it. Now, if you remove RTÉ as a global hub for Irish music, Where's the global hub for Irish music? It is a way of Irish musicians bringing their music to the whole world, not just around Ireland. So we need to protect it. I'm concerned about that. And that's why I write about it quite frequently, because I think we need to hang on to what we have. And it is an extensive infrastructure at this stage. That's not to say that I think everything is perfect on RTE, but this is a crisis. And I know that I really want to make sure that, you know, the music side is highlighted all the time, because certainly my generation had it growing up, and we need to make sure that at least it's there for the next generation so that they have the same opportunities that we had to bring our music to the world, for it to be broadcast, for it to be discussed. This is, you know, music and broadcasting, they go hand in hand. If you remove music from the output of a national broadcaster, you know, you're losing a huge amount. It is very, very dependent on music, and music is very, very dependent on broadcasting. So we need to actually highlight that intricate relationship that they have together and not just let it slip away as if it was something that was optional. It's not optional.
We're nearing the end of our conversation, and I don't want to end on a negative note, because there's so many positive notes in this book. But one of the things, you know, in 2018, you had a piece that you published, which is in the book, How Musicians Can Start to Afford Ireland. And, you know, despite all the changes for the better in terms of recognition, you mentioned confidence there, you know, it's easier to make a recording, there are more opportunities in education, it's still virtually impossible to make your living as a musician in Ireland. I know you've brought up Ace Donna before, for example, in terms of people who have spent their lives in traditional music. What do you think we could do to make that better?
Well, I'd like to say that the tide is turning slightly. The basic income for the artists is a significant development. It's kind of a little miracle. It's only at the pilot stage, but I think there is a determination there that that would be broadened out. That is going to have a big impact on music. But musicians need to be organised. They just need to be organised. You know, there are lots of other creative sectors which do not have the problems that musicians have. We could talk about the film sector or the TV sector, where people organise. There's creative people involved in those as well, and they're organised, and they have minimum rates, and they have a way of putting their case forward. And musicians are just not organised in the same way. And that's the first step that we could take. We can't just hope that the government will solve everything for us. With a little bit of pressure from the bottom, things will be solved. And I mean, I'm part of, you know, a new group, umbrella group, which is Music Alliance of Ireland. And we are trying to bring music organisations together to talk about these issues. It won't happen unless we're organised. Plenty of other sectors are organised. We're not. I don't know why that happens. I don't know why music is not organised in a similar way. It could be that the creative life just overwhelms everything else. And that's quite possible. Very difficult to find the time for other things. But it's something we... Change will not happen unless we're organised. That's the way I'd look at it.
Going back to your fiddle playing to finish, you talk about being at Sculsari Willie Clancy and being in Tommy Peoples' fiddle class. Tell me how Tommy Peoples taught music in Sculsari Willie Clancy.
Well, you see, isn't that interesting that kind of how he's such a famous musician and now he's gone, but how he taught. He would sit at the top of the class when we walked in, and he would be rolling cigarettes, and he would have a metal case, and he wouldn't really look at us as we walked in. And then when the class was ready to start, the metal case would close with a snap and the fiddle case would open, and then he would play a tune and ask us to learn it, and then go round the class and ask each one of us to play it on our own, and then give us one line of feedback for everybody. And it was absolutely spot on every time. And I can still remember the tunes he taught us. Fairy Queen, Spike Island Lasses. But he had a very simple approach, but I can remember it 30 years later.
Amazing. An amazing musician. I think you say as well, you know, that he has his book and he published his book and there's notation, but it's still, you can't still play like Tommy Peoples just by looking at the book or even listening to the CDs. He was so unique. Look, Toner, there's so much more we could talk about. The book is called What Ireland Can Teach the World About Music and Other Essays. And I want to congratulate you, because as I said in the introduction, your writings, you know, whether one agrees with you all the time or not, they're always stimulating, they're always thought-provoking. And it's extremely valuable to have a voice like that in the world of music. So congratulations on the achievement of keeping the Journal of Music going and relevant since 2000. And especially congratulations on the publication of this very interesting book. It's published through the Journal of Music. It's available on thejournalofmusic.com, as well as many bookshops nationwide. And there's a list of stockists on your website. So, Gormila Magat, Sucht Velin, Erin Rolling Wave, Brichas Freshen, Le John Doyle, and Mon Fuime, Thuin, and Cho Ing Olive. Thanks for listening to RTÉ Radio 1's The Rolling Wave podcast with me, Aoife Ní Coirmic. Until the next time, Gormila Magaí, agus slán.